Hi everybody, welcome to Spotlight, and on this occasion, which is the Christmas Spotlight really, I suppose, we're closest to Christmas we're going to get for a Spotlight, it's my very great pleasure to introduce someone from Scotland to you, but before I do that, I'd just like to thank Becky for all her work behind the scenes, and to Dennis for recording Spotlight for archive purposes. I'm Steve, of course, in the centre of England, I forgot to say that, but welcome anyway to you all. And on this occasion, I'm going to introduce someone to you who you know pretty well. He appears on the site quite often. He's in disguise at the moment as Christmas Troubadour, but his family and friends and associates all know him as John Duff. John, welcome to Spotlight, and can I begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about your early life? For instance, where were you born? And a little bit about your family.
Well, I was born in a little village called, believe it or not, Shorts, which is situated midway between our two main cities here in Scotland, between Glasgow and Edinburgh. My mum was a seamstress, and my dad worked down the mines. It's, you know, Shorts was a local community with a mine. Scotland was a mining nation up till about 10 years ago. And there's one coal mine left, one deep mine left in Scotland. And my dad worked down the pits. Really, before I was born, just before he had an accident and he was told that he would never walk again, but he did. He managed to get up and go and get married, and that's when I came into existence. But you know, it's nice being here in Scotland, and I must take this opportunity to thank everybody for even Jennifer and Becky asking me to take part in the Spotlight interview. It's a privilege and an honour.
It's a pleasure to have you, John, believe you me, and I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating interview, because we've had a little chat before and I know what's coming, and I'm really excited to gradually reveal it to the people in the room here. Do you have any brothers and sisters? Have you got any siblings?
Yeah. I've got a younger sister. She lives down in your neck of the woods, down in Huddersfield. Not far away from Leicester, but, you know, down England way. And my brother, I lost my brother unfortunately last year, but at this time he had multiple sclerosis and he sadly passed away, and I miss him quite a lot. Mum and dad, they're both gone now, and I've got a son and three grandchildren. One son I don't see anything of, another grandson. Well, I should say a grandson I don't see much of. My other grandson, Greg, he's a regular visitor to this house. My little granddaughter, who unfortunately took ill last night, and it turned out she'd a hernia. She's just 2.5 years of age, and what a shame. She was taken into hospital, but she's fine now. They're going to take her in the new year for an operation, and hopefully that'll solve that. Little tiny problem.
Yes, John, we all wish a speedy recovery, of course. The last thing we want is for your granddaughter to be in hospital over Christmas, so I'm sure we all wish her well. Tell us a little bit about your early childhood. Have you always had a problem with your eyesight, or were you sighted when you were a child?
Well, actually, I had a fair bit of sight. And the problem started, you know, when I was born, but I didn't know that. You know, difficult to know at that age. But, you know, my mum and dad realised there was something wrong when I kept walking into things. And they took me to a doctor and they got my eyes tested, etc. And they found out I had detached retinas. So they operated 1959, 2 days before Christmas, and the operation didn't work. And 10 years later, 1969, on exactly the same day, 2 days before my birthday, they operated in the right eye, and it didn't work either. But, again, it's just a chance you take, and whether it's 50-50 or less, you just have to take that opportunity. They told me I would lose it anyway. I didn't have a choice. But to prepare me, they did send me to the Royal Blind School here in Edinburgh, and I spent 3 or 4 very unhappy years living in an institution I didn't like. But it's all part of growing up, you know, part of living, Steve.
So how old were you, John, when you had the first eye operation in 1959, and what had been your schooling up until that point?
Well, I went to an ordinary primary school, and I just started secondary school. No, I was just about to start secondary school, that was it. Yeah. I was at a normal school in shorts with normal kids. You know, and I used to wear those thick bottom glasses. Like the Milky Bar kid. And, you know, it was crazy. I suppose, like a lot of educational establishments at that time, if you realised you didn't see very well, they sat you at the front of the class and you still couldn't see the boards or anything. It was just a nightmare. I didn't learn a lot simply because the natural flow of things, because they didn't know what really to do to try and help me. There wasn't a great deal of large print available. So, you know, they just did what they did. And I just wish they could have done more. I might be more intelligent.
So, what were you, around about 9 when you went to the School for the Blind in Edinburgh, is that right? I think my calculations would tell me that's probably round about the age you would have been. And it must have come as a very, very big shock, I should think, to go away to boarding school. What were your memories of those days?
Well, again, Steve, maybe I'll get mixed up a bit in the teen dilemma. No, I was actually 13 when I went to the Royal Blind School. Although I'd lost my sight in the left eye, I still had some sight in the right eye, so they kept me on at school, and my mum and dad fought to get me to a special school. So they did accept me into the Royal Blind School. It was one of those establishments that, like many places at the time, it was very institutionalised, very regimental, very class orientated, I'm afraid to say, as well. Coming from a working class background, I felt I wasn't treated very well. And as you said, being in a boarding school, that was frightening on its own. There was no backup, nothing. Okay, I'm being negative here. But thinking back, I can't find anything positive to say, except they taught me Braille. They taught me to use the white cane, and, you know, they tried to institutionalise me. It didn't work, but because I was a rebel from the word.
Okay, believe it or not, guys, I've got a bad connection at the moment, so I hope you're hearing me. What would you say was the best thing about going to the School for the Blind in Edinburgh? What did they teach you there which has been of most use to you?
Truthfully, Steve, nothing really. Absolutely nothing at all. I learned more when I left the blind school, and, you know, in my early 20s, I went back into mainstream education, and I got higher English, higher modern studies. I did a media studies course as well, and really, at the Royal Blind School, whether it was my background or what, I wouldn't get any educational qualifications, and I did prove them wrong. I hope things are different. As I say, they tended more then to deal with, I don't know, living in a Victorian era, well, with Victorian rules, regulations, and really, honestly, Steve, I just didn't get any gains from the school at all. Sorry to say that, it seems negative, but I just can't think of anything positive to say at all.
That's fine, Johnny, if that's how you found it, that's how you found it, and you can only speak as you find, you know, as we say. So, when did your interest in music begin? And when did you first want to learn to play the guitar, for instance, which I know...
Well, give me just a sec, Steve, there the Right, Steve, I'm back. Sorry about that. Yeah, you were saying about the guitar. I started learning the guitar just before I lost my sight, and although it was very, very traumatic, it was probably one of the most traumatic parts of my life. I still continued to learn the guitar after I'd lost my sight, and I got interested in country music when a neighbour gave me a Johnny Cash album, and it was Folsom Prison Blues. I listened to it and I just, yep, I said, that's for me. That's definitely for me. You know, again, it goes back to probably my own roots. My mum sang it in a probably one of the first country bands in Scotland, a band called Big Bill Campbell and his Rocky Mountain Rhythm. They played in a theatre called The Pavilion in Glasgow in the early 40s, and my mum sang with them. She was a gorgeous singer. At times I can still hear her singing those old ones, you know, like Scarlet Ribbons, and, you know, just memories, really, really nice memories.
Yeah, lovely, John. Yes, sir. I do know those songs a little bit myself. I'm a little bit familiar with those, and I'm sure many people in the room are too. Before we really start to find out about the musical side of your life, John, can I just take you back and ask you what actually happened to you then after you'd left the School for the Blind in Edinburgh, which you obviously found very traumatic and didn't enjoy at all. What happened next?
Well, like a lot of blind people in this country, they get sent to what they call pre-vocational assessment centres. There's one in Scotland here, at a little place called Ceres in Fife. There's a few down in England, and I was sent to the one in Torquay, Manor House. It was unique. Again, it was just a step from the Royal Blind School. Very regimented, very institutionalised. They assessed me like 90% of blind people who go there for engineering, which was okay. I didn't mind that because my dad, when he eventually got a job, he trained to be an engineer, so it wasn't too bad. I thought that the job prospects were quite good. But one thing that did really, really amuse me was the head guy down there, in what they call the intake, you're asked what you would like to do in life, and you write it down for them. And I wrote to be a country music correspondent, or a country music DJ, or a country music singer-songwriter. And they laughed. And I'm not joking, they laughed. Boy, they laughed. When I left that place and came back home, a few years down the line, I did write for the local newspapers. Not getting paid for it, but I did write a country music column. And I eventually became the resident DJ in the Grand Old Opry. And I did write and sing my own songs. I made a record. And got the information together and sent a letter down to him. I got a nice little letter back saying, you know, good for you. But it just shows you that you can sometimes just be put down for what you believe in.
Good for you, John. Good for you. One in the eye for them, so to speak. So how long were you actually at Torquay? I think they're not terribly long courses, are they, John, or long periods? It doesn't run into years, does it? How long were you actually there? And did they actually think that you would be suitable for any particular engineering job, or was it just general engineering?
Well, I think the sort of standard time you're there is 3 months. When I went there, I was quite young. I just left the blind school and the new life, enjoyed it, and I met my very first girlfriend there. And she managed to get me a flat in Torquay. And I just stayed on there for a little while, soaking up that nice warm sun, etc. Yeah, it was good. It was really good, that part of it was. But, yeah, a standard 2 months course, Stephen. They did assess me for any engineering job at all. Latterly, I did go to Letchworth, one of the main training centres here in the UK, for engineering. And I passed that with flying colours. But, yeah, you just brought back some nice memories there, Steve. Yeah, Torquay, that was way cool.
Yeah, I just fill in for the people in the States. Torquay is miles away from where you live. Torquay is on the south-west coast of England, and you are in Scotland, so it's several hundred miles, isn't it? It's, you know, quite a long way for us in the UK. So you obviously weren't really interested in doing engineering. You really wanted to be involved in country music. You said that you ended up writing a country music column for the local newspaper. Can you tell us how that came about, John, and how practically you actually did that?
Yeah, no problem, Steve. I was, at the time, I did a few what they call hospital radio shows. One of the very first country music shows in a local hospital here. I did that, you know, regularly. And one of the guys that did a show just, you know, next to mine, was a reporter for the local newspaper, and he knew the editor, and they had a word with him, and, you know, it turned out, you know, that country music was getting popular at the time. So they said, yeah, well, why not? We'll give it a go. And I wrote for them for about 2 or 3 years until an editor took over, who was a jazz fanatic, and said, no, we don't like country music anymore. It's just one of those, right, just the points of, it's something I use quite a lot, it's a rich tapestry of life that's so full of ups and downs.
Yeah, I know what you mean, John. So how, in a practical sense, did you do the column? Did you do it on tape? Did you write it on a, you know, typewriter? Or how did it actually work? How did you actually physically do it? And what did you review? Did you review albums or shows? Just give us a feel for what the column was.
Yeah, I actually covered everything in the local area. At the time, country music was getting big, really big, and we had maybe a dozen or so country music clubs in the west of Scotland, and I'd visit them quite regularly. So I'd either write about the clubs that I went to, or if there was a new LP released, I'd write about that. Anything at all that I thought would be of interest to country music fans, or people in general who picked up a newspaper and saw this column. But what I would do was, I know a rickety old typewriter, an Olivetti, Yeah, I'll never forget it. I probably must have made about a million mistakes with it. But I did the column. Yeah, I always remember it. 250 words. That was what it had to be. Exactly. Precisely. And I did it. And it's just that you learned a lot from condensing a lot of information into a small area. It was a learning curve that I really thoroughly enjoyed.
And I'm sure you made a very good job of it, as you do everything you seem to tackle, John. I'm sure it was excellent, and I'm sure it was missed when the editor decided he didn't want it anymore. It's their loss, I tell you. You mentioned that you were involved in hospital radio as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and maybe explain the concept of hospital radio, because I'm not sure if they have such a thing in America. So just tell us how that came about.
Yeah, no problem, Steve. One of the guys that I used to go to the local country western clubs with, he was actually in the local hospital, and he told me that they were looking for DJs. So both him and I went up, and we checked out the system, and it was an antiquated system, if you can picture, well, compared to what it is now. If you can picture a desk, maybe 2 feet by 3 feet, with a variety of knobs and controls on it, 2 record players, slider volume controls for the microphones and for the turntables. So again, it was a learning curve that you had to learn how to operate different things, slider control for the volume and the turntable, left, right, the microphone, etc., and 1 or 2 buttons to switch it back to the main radio stations when the show was finished. You know, different, a variety of things, just like that. But the feedback I always got was excellent. I tried at that time to go around 1 or 2 different wards, taking requests from visitors, which gained popularity. It really did. I found that other DJs did start doing the same, taking requests from visitors and playing them over the air. The patients seemed to enjoy it. They really did. It was like being a part of a community. The hospital maybe had, it was not a hospital with different levels. It was the old-fashioned kind of hospital with the long wards and way, way out in the middle of nowhere where they tended to build these hospitals. I'm glad to say it's now shut down and they've built a new local hospital. And I do hear they're looking for DJs. You know, you never know. I could go back in again and give it a try.
Yeah, I'm sure they'd welcome you back with open arms, John. And I know that you've also done a little bit of live DJing in, is it the Grand Old Opry in Edinburgh or Glasgow? I probably committed a terrible sin, because I know there's some rivalry between the two cities, so I apologise to both of them. But can you tell us a little bit about your experiencing as a live DJ playing country music?
Oh yeah, that was an experience that was, it's just so special. The Grand Old Opry here in Glasgow is a mecca for country music in Scotland. It's the largest, largest building. It used to be an old cinema, and they converted it. So you can imagine the height of the ceiling and the acoustics. It was and still is excellent. What happened was, I'd gone to an annual general meeting of the club, and the DJ walked out. So it left the position rather vacant. So I just said, well, you know, I've got DJ experience, you know, can I have a go? And they said, yes, we'll give you a try. And the controls were very, very much like the hospital radio controls, the record decks, the slider controls. That was, that all fitted in fairly well. But instead of talking to someone who were in the hospital bed, I was talking to a live audience, which was, slightly different. There's a lot of interesting experiences, a lot of nice people that I met from all over the world that used to come in and come up with our chat. A guy from New York, he used to come over regularly. And some of the people who attended were unique characters in themselves. I remember one guy, his name was Hoss. He was a huge, huge guy, 6 foot tall and 6 foot wide. And he used to come in, his professional job was an all-in wrestler. That was his professional job. When he came in, shake your hand and say, "Hi, John." When he was going away, he was drunk and he wanted to give you a cuddle. I thought quite a few times I was going to end up with broken ribs.
Yeah, I bet you did. So how long did you do this DJ at the Grand Ole Opry in Glasgow? And was it a daily, nightly event or once a week? How long did that last, John?
Well, that lasted about 3.5 years, Steve. It was a Friday, Saturday and Sunday night. Friday night was jumping. It was busy. Really, really busy. Saturday night, depending on the band, certain bands had quite a good following. Again, it was fairly busy. Sunday night, just really laid back, relaxed, just try some new things, night. Maybe 30, 40 people. But if there was a good band on, then the crowd would come on a Sunday night. I remember one Sunday night when it was quiet, thank goodness, that this old lady got me up to dance, and 5 dances later I'm still standing there dancing, and I didn't know my way back to the table, and I didn't have the cane either. It was getting to be on the edge of, no, don't want this anymore. That was a frightening experience, and she wanted to take me home to meet her family. And I was fairly young at the time, and she was fairly old.
Oh, lucky escape there, John, I think. Now, tell us a little bit about your songwriting. I know you do write songs, and I've heard some of them, and they're absolutely great. And I'm not too sure if Terry's here at the moment. I'm not too sure if he's actually in the room, but I think possibly we're going to hear one of your songs if he is. If he isn't, well, we can't, unfortunately. But tell us a little bit about your songwriting. When did that begin? And I'm always fascinated to know with people who can do this sort of thing, which comes first? Do the melody come first to you, or do the lyrics come first? Obviously, the idea has to come first of all, but how does it actually work for you, John?
For me, Steve, it can either come either, I know it's strange, there's no set routine, there's no set pattern to it. I can either be sitting just picking the guitar and a tune will just come into my head in words, or if I hear particularly nice words and I think, that sounds really nice, I just put them on my tape machine and, keep the words for a future reference. What I sometimes tend to do is build a song, get an idea in my head for a song. If someone wants a particular song, like the first song I ever recorded was Country Music Friends, and that was written to thank people for a big sponsored walk I did from Glasgow down to London. That was a distance of 400 miles. And I did that to thank them. So there was a thank you in it, but there was the other side to it as well. It was the B-side of a record given to a charity here in Scotland called the Muscular Dystrophy Charity. I think most people know what that disease is. It's a tragic disease. Well, a couple of friends of mine, again, connected to the country western scene, they asked me to write a song about them and their son, and that was called My Friend's Son. Again, about the traumatic events surrounding a family bringing up a couple, bringing up a child with muscular dystrophy, which is in itself a traumatic and really, really courageous thing to do. So I put that on the record, and let them sell it for charity. And they made about £3,000 at the time, which was, I was dead chuffed. I didn't make anything, and that wasn't a problem. I just loved doing it for them. And the sad thing was that the country music shows, radio stations refused to play it because it was too sad. It is sad, but it's a true song, and it was written about true life. And again, Steve, going back to what I was saying, the way it was written was just, I heard the story and I wrote the song.
Fine, well, I'm very delighted to say that I've just had word to say that we can actually hear one of your songs. It's a Christmas song, and before we hear it, can you just give us a little bit of background to how the song came about, and then we'll actually sit back and listen to it.
Yeah, sure, Steve. I've always, well, since I started songwriting, I've always wanted to write a Christmas country song that was both traditional but had a lot of different meanings to it. Not superficial. If you looked a bit deeper than the superficial storyline, you'll find a lot. Well, when I say hidden, I don't actually mean hidden, but I mean reflections on different aspects of Christmas. I think Christmas being traditionally snowy, giving presents, etc. Then the opposite side to that, you know, people celebrate Christmas in sunny climes like Australia, Florida, etc. It's still Christmas. The weather's not traditional, but it's still filled with the same spirit, the spirit that should be there. And as we grow old, sometimes we reflect back in our youth and think how simple Christmases were then, and how they're not simple nowadays, and how there's still a lot of anguish and loneliness out there in the world. And you know, the chorus of that particular song, you know, I wanted it to reflect it, even although you could be in a crowded room at Christmas time, where we're all supposed to feel happy and jolly, etc., we can still feel lonely, and there's still a lot of lonely people out there, there's still a lot of homeless people out there, and it's really my way of saying, you know, Christmas should be for everyone to enjoy, you know, and just stop for a minute and think about what the real meaning of Christmas is, not the cosmetic, commercialised Christmas we see today. I hope that helps, Steve.
That's wonderful, John. Okay, now you've set the background for us, and I'm going to ask our very good friend Parker to play it in for us. So, next thing you'll hear is John's Christmas song.
Snowflakes fall so gently to the ground. In a little while, turning to winter wonderland. Stars so bright, you can almost hear old Santa Claus. Children sleeping while we dream about a time that was. This time of year, you might see a tear on a lonely face in a crowd. The sparkling eyes of a little child. Little child without a home. Sun is shining, children playing in the sand. It's still Christmas, the same dream, a different land. Whisper peace, change everyone who lives in hate. Teach our world how to love before it's too late. This time of year, you might see a tear on a lonely face in a crowded room. The sparkling eyes of a little child, a little child. Without a home.
John, that was beautiful. Thanks very much indeed. I'm sure if you could hear the applause echoing all around the world, you'd be deafened. That's absolutely gorgeous. And thanks very much indeed for explaining the song to us. And, you know, it made a lot more sense when you knew the meaning behind it. You're a very, very talented guy, John. So, after your experiences in the Grand Ole Opry and the newspaper column and hospital radio and so on, what was the next big significant thing which happened in your life?
Well, probably, yeah, probably the biggest thing was, like many good country songs, yeah, my wife went away with another woman. Yeah, unfortunately she did. So I had to climb that hurdle again. And it's when I met Nikki, friends who's staying with me just now. You know, again, so you could write so many country songs about your own life. But the biggest traumatic event after that, or between that, was that I undergone a quadruple heart bypass, just like a friend Terry on the site. For 2.5 years, they thought it was a stomach problem, and it turned out to be the old ticker. Well, the old ticker's okay, it's just the tubes going to it were kind of blocked, and they took me into a hospital when they operated, and it was a long haul back up the way from that point on, Steve. So, quite a few traumatic events there.
I'll say, that's something to keep you occupied. Isn't it? My goodness, what a what a catalogue of unhappy events there for you, John. But let's get on to more cheerful things. Your ambition to be involved in country music was probably really fired up by now, so let's take you forward a little way and ask you, what was the next big step in your country music life?
Well, I suppose that's where for the people came in, going back to college, trying to get out the rut I was in, learning about the computer, Windows, the program in particular, but Windows, I mean, coming on for the people, getting a lot of confidence boost from everyone I met on here. They may not realise how big an influence they have been in my life, but they really have. Each and every one has been an absolutely amazing influence, Steve. And, you know, I've got to thank them all. And at this point, I'd like to say, hi, Pat. It's Miles since we've heard you, and I know you're going to get a recording of this tape. You take care, and hope to hear you soon. You know, so it stemmed from there, going back to college, Steve, coming on for the people, getting a bit of confidence, coming on the net, and going visiting sites, and visited a country music website here in Scotland, and I wrote to the woman who ran it. She wrote back, and I'm now working for them. Not getting paid, of course, which is the downside to it, but the upside is that, you know, I'm getting out and about now, and it's getting out of the rut I was in. And then I'm now writing for another website in Nashville. It's, again, not getting paid for it at the moment, but the perks are something special. All the big country shows that are coming over here, that means press passes, interviewing the big stars. You know, going back in a full circle, going to do something that I'd done years ago, interviewing big stars down at the big International Country Festival in Wembley. So it's going for full circle again, Steve, but again, it's thanks to a lot of good friends on here.
Yeah, okay, you've jumped forward a little bit, John. When we were having our little chat yesterday, you did tell me that in the 70s, you decided to hitchhike to Wembley, which is in London, and you're in Scotland. Now, why on earth did you decide to do that?
Well, that was another thing. I'd been going to a local country music club they call Nashville Club, and there were people there going down to didn't have a great deal of money. I couldn't get a ticket on a train, so I decided, yeah, why not hitchhike it? So me and my guitar, we hitchhiked it all the way down to London, and I got to Wembley, which is a huge arena. There is a football stadium, but it's just next door to it. And every Easter, they have a big, big international festival with all the big stars. Kenny Rogers, Don Williams, Johnny Cash, Waylon, Steve Earle, Tammy, Crystal Gayle, you name it. Thousands of people have went through there. And I arrived there, and I spoke to one of the stewards, and he took me down the stairs to the staff canteen, and this is a really, really true story. When I went downstairs, the guy that took my guitar, you'll never believe it, in each one of you here I've heard the guy's name. He's called Carol Perkins. He carried my guitar to a table, and he sat, the steward sat me down, and Carol went and got me a cup of tea, and, well, a cup of coffee. And we had a chat, and it was just amazing. I didn't think anything of it. Frank, the steward, actually put me up in his home that night, and the next day, just like the whole world had opened up for me. You know, my story was in every major newspaper in the UK, that this blind guy had hitchhiked 400 miles, you know, just to get to a country music festival, and man, what a weekend. I didn't expect it. I wasn't looking for it. I just wanted to go somewhere I wanted to go, and we kind of met one of my idols, and that was Merle Haggard, and I said I was proud to meet him, and he said he was more proud to meet me. I don't know why, but it was really amazing. He dedicated two songs to me on stage, and that was, I think that really made my full weekend.
Yeah, I can't resist it, John. You'll have to forgive me. Did Carl Perkins say, "Don't you step on my blue suede shoes"? I'm sorry, I just had to throw that in. I just couldn't resist it. But what year was this, Sir John? Are we talking mid-70s now? Because we've backtracked a little bit now. So are we in the 70s?
Yeah, in actual fact, we are 79, Steve. Was it 78? 78, I think it was. Yeah, 78.
Yeah, and you say you actually hitchhiked. Did you hitchhike alone? I mean, boy, I can't imagine anything more challenging than London. It's a heck of a way. Did you go on your own? And if so, any stories about your trip, your adventures?
Not really. From what I remember, Steve, it was a case of I get dropped off at the slip road to the motorway. It's not, at that point in time, it really wasn't a motorway. It was a dual carriageway between Scotland and England. And I just sort of stood there with a thumb up. I'd never done it before. I'd heard about it. Yeah, I got picked up with this truck driver, of course. And he dropped me off at the very first services that I'd ever been in, at a little place called Carlisle, just over the border. And I remember talking to the woman in the canteen, and they said that was crazy, totally crazy. Why is a blind guy like yourself just doing this? And I tried to explain it was just something that I felt that I had to do. Somehow I just had to get to Wembley. I didn't know why. Well, the reason was, to get to the festival, to hear the, the people that I'd always admired. But no, there was nothing traumatic at all, fortunately, Steve. It was probably one of the craziest things I've done. But it's just part of that rich tapestry of life.
It's strange how these things happen, isn't it? Sometimes events happen in your life, and looking back on it, you understand why they happened and that they were very significant in your life. So after this weekend and this media exposure, I suppose, as you say, all the newspapers got out of it and so on, did you sort of think to yourself, okay, well, maybe there's a niche for me here, maybe I can forward my interest in country music by, because I know you have actually interviewed very many, many famous people, and I'll ask you to name some of them in a moment, but what gave you the idea that you could maybe interview these guys and gals and carve out a little niche for yourself?
Sorry, Steve, that was, I was only getting part of that. What was the last part you said? What gave me the idea? Of what?
Yeah, I hope you can hear me now, John. I was just saying, after you'd been to the Wembley Festival and met your heroes, what put it into your mind that maybe you could further your interest in country music by interviewing these people, which I know you've interviewed many, many famous people. But what gave you the idea?
Again, I think it was just, at that time, that's when the hospital radio situation became, just came into my life. And just it all merged together, and I said, well, why not just do that? In actual fact, friends that I'm still in contact with today, that we had a special room in Wembley for all the hospital radio people, and a good friend of mine, Peter Lamb, from Woolwich. Him and I became great friends through it. And, you know, I was just being interviewed in the hospital radio room that just really added everything together. And I said, yeah, I can do this. I said, you know, there's no reason why I can't. And I just went for the whole hog and said, yeah, okay. Found out how to do it and how to go about it. Yeah, I did that for a long time and thoroughly enjoyed every minute of it.
Now, as we mentioned, you've interviewed many, many famous country stars. Just reel off a few and let people drool at the names you're going to come out with.
Yeah, probably one of the most famous is George Jones. I even took him down two bottles of Scottish beer, which he thoroughly enjoyed. I know he's an alcoholic. I'm not sure if he's reformed yet or not, but he had quite a reputation. But he did enjoy the beer, that's for sure. And Tammy Winnett and I, you know, we were on the first name terms. And she always spoke. Skeeter Davis, well, she was another character in country music. She became a reborn again Christian, and she tried so hard to convert me one weekend. But she's just a gorgeous person. There's a guy, I spoke to Steve last night. This one particular guy, what an overwhelming personality. He just was so open. One of the old guys, a guy called Freddie Hart, and what a guy. His personality just was there. It was so open, so warm, so loving, just an amazing person. I think he did a song called A Country Boy Named Joe or something, about two truck drivers, one from the north and one from the south. It was good. That's one guy that really stand out in my mind. Of course, Merle Haggard. I had an experience where I met Johnny Cash and didn't even know it. At one of the festivals out with London, it was in a place called Portsmouth, again in the late 70s. My ex-wife, well, my wife at the time, had gone to buy something, and a friend and I were standing behind stage, and this crowd of people came towards us. They pushed me out of the way, and they went either side of me, and this guy said, hi there, and I said, hi. When the crowd went by, Mary came across, and she said, John, do you know who just spoke to you? I said, well, I haven't a clue. She said it was Johnny Cash. One guy had never managed to meet, but he did, well, I did actually meet him and didn't even know.
Oh, John, how awful. And maybe one day you'll get the opportunity to say more than hi to him. You just reeled off a great list of very, very famous people. Have you been surprised by any of these people when you've met them in real life, or have they all lived up to your expectations?
Again, Steve, meeting them, interviewing them, it's slightly different from getting to know them on a personal level. Although, I did find that with most of them, they did compliment me on making them feel at ease. I don't know if it's a general thing with interviewers, but I try and make people feel at ease when I'm talking to them. And that, you know, that goes part and parcel with interviewing. As you know, Steve, it's a complex process. And if you don't get the flow right, it's gone. As you used that very big word last night. After a time, you know, you do get to know people, not relatively well, but well enough to know what areas to stay away from. And I tended to stay away from their personal life. I think that's them, you know, that's out of bounds as far as I'm concerned. I'm more interested in the music and how it's made and a bit about their personality. There wasn't one bad person at all. Sometimes there were a few arrogant people, but believe it or not, they tended to be people who were pop coming into country. I find them more arrogant than the real country folks, because 9 times out of 10, the real country people had hard backgrounds. You know, they didn't get it handed to them on a silver spoon. You know, they really, you know, came from the backwoods and learned about it raw. It's amazing. It is amazing, Steve. But, you know, I love just talking to people, and I think it reflects in how they react towards me. You know, a few people have asked for me in particular, you know, to interview them. And the press guy who ran Wembley, Warren Davies, got to know him personally, and, you know, it's such a proud thing when the guy who runs the whole press, the entire show, the press show down there, says, I wonder, John, can you spare a quarter of an hour just to have a chat with Porter Wagner and make him feel relaxed? I think that said it all, Steve, but I was so proud of that. It just really, that was something else.
Do you think you get more out of the personalities because of your visual handicap? Maybe they feel more relaxed with you? Do you ever feel that you can draw things out of these, you know, mega stars, which maybe other journalists and people who interview them from radio stations all over the world can't?
Yeah, because we use senses. Although sighted people use senses and they see eye contact is one of the main things. Well, we lost it that way. But although people can disguise their voices, they can't disguise where the voices are coming from. It's a strange phenomenon, and I can't explain it. It's just a gift, really. You just can't tell with a person's voice the sincerity, and I think if you relate your sincerity to them, then they too feel relaxed and confident. And 9 times out of 10, what does happen is we always run over time with interviews, and somebody will just tap me on the shoulder to wind the interview up. But but I think that was one of the enjoyable parts. It always worked out that way, Steve, that the interview.
At this point, we got booted from the server, so Steve's going to ask his question again.
Do you feel that because of your visual impairment, you can draw more out of these megastars than maybe sighted journalists or people who work for radio stations all over the world?
Yes. That was a joke, folks. Steve and I, we had a lot of conversation last night. And we were talking about people. We have interviewed both of us, and they do have very short, to-the-point answers. Fortunately, they're very rare. But when they do happen, they do throw us. To answer Steve's point, yeah, being blind does. One particular guy I remember from Texas called Wesley Parker. Unfortunately, I've never been able to trace him. I'd love to have a chat with him again. He wrote a song about his first flight. He was a chopper pilot in Vietnam, and he wrote a song about his first flight into Vietnam. No, well, his first chopper flight in Vietnam. That was amazing. And again, at the end of the interview, which ran over time as usual, he thanked me, you know, for letting him open up a little, which I found good. I think it does, Steve. I think because of our blindness, we have other gifts which come into play, and people once they get to know us, the fear and any preconceived idea that they may have of blind people is gone. And, you know, going back to the point, when people ask you by name, then you've done something special. But I think just being me, not trying to be someone else, not trying to be big-headed or overconfident, just be me, just be natural, I think, is the approach that paid off, and it's one I've stuck with. So, really, to answer your question, yeah, blindness, it makes you aware of other senses and makes you use other senses, and as you said, it works for me, works fine.
Yeah, we've only got people's voices to pick up on, and you're right, we get pretty skilled at learning what people are like and how they're feeling emotionally and all the rest of it. We're pretty adept at that because that's the only feedback we get 99.9% of the time, isn't it? So, just let's move you forward a little bit, John, because talking about people tapping you on the shoulder, I don't want to overrun too long, and we are overrunning now a little bit. I think you told me that the next big adventure in your life was to do a sponsored walk from Glasgow, or was it Edinburgh, to London. Now, why did you decide to do this?
Did that for a couple of reasons. It was from the Grand Old Opry in Glasgow to the Country Music Festival down in London. I did it to promote country music and to raise money for, well, what we call the Guide Dog Association for the Blind. I think you guys call it the Seeing Eye Dogs. Trying again to go beyond something, trying to get a job, trying to get out of the rut I was in. When eventually, going back the way a little bit, I did go to Letchworth, a big engineering place for training us blind people over here, and eventually got a job for 2 years and get made redundant because they brought in computers. How ironic. But, you know, I did it to make people aware that blind people were in the community and, you know, we were part of the community. So, as I say, I did it for two reasons, to promote country music and to raise money for the Guide Dogs. And it was quite a journey, 420 miles and all. Well, that's what they had in the sponsorship. And I got to a little place called East Grinstead where to stay with someone. And you checked the sponsorship for them. Tagged cruelly and cruelly. It was only 280 miles the journey I took to London. So they made me walk another 40 miles the next day.
Oh, that's a bit unfair. So how long did it take you to walk this 400-odd miles, John, from Glasgow to London?
Yeah, this is the other frightening thing. I did it on my own most of the way. One or two sections I was accompanied. But I walked between 15 and 20 miles a day, and it took me 2 weeks to do it. And I visited your neck of the woods, Steve. There's a big country western club down in Leicester. Yeah, I remember being there that day. That was good. The intention was going to a country western venue each night and raising money. I didn't take any money with me. It went directly into the Guide Dog Association, you know, straight into their funds or a trust account set up with a friend of mine. So either way, I wasn't, you know, taking any chances with money. That was quite important, just in case anything happened.
Very wise, even in those days, you know. But even today, even more of a risk, I should think. But you say you were unaccompanied most of the way. How on earth did you know where you were going? I mean, did you plan the route meticulously before you left? I just can't imagine being able to do that unaccompanied, John, because that's a heck of a walk.
Well, Steve, but fortunately, and you've no idea, if you don't go near towns, I know this might sound amazing to you, but it really is true. Maybe not so much nowadays, but if you don't go near towns and you stick to even dual carriageways, which are allowed to walk down the grass yards, that's fine. And there's not any obstacles at all, which is another good thing. Because I walked down what they call the old A1, down, I went from here over to the east coast down to Jedburgh, Newcastle, that way. It's relatively straight, believe it or not, Steve. There's not many cut-offs, but what part of the journey, it was coordinated by members of that particular local country music club who set me on the road and gave me directions in the morning on a tape, and, you know, I followed that each day till I got to a point where I was met with someone from, you know, the next country western club, and that's the way it worked all the way down.
Excellent, excellent, and well done to you. I don't know how many blind people would tackle such a project, but obviously you tackled it with gusto and came out on top. Okay, John, we're going to begin to wind up now. So is there anything of major significance that we haven't covered which you'd like to mention at this point before we just wrap up the interview?
No, just really to thank everybody. And I think one of the most significant things in part of my life is meeting people and making friends. One guy on here I made a good friend with, in particular, not just one, but everyone that I've spoken to, I hope, you know, that we're all part of a huge family, and friendship and caring and love is part of that. And for the people, is just the biggest thing ever to happen to me. Without that, I wouldn't be talking to you guys tonight. I wouldn't be taking a dip into my life, you know, the part that can be publicised anyway, or isn't X-rated. That is the most significant part, Steve. For the people and everyone in it, they've all been superb and fantastic, and a good guy from Scotland here, Bob, as well. And yourself. I think, really, at the end of the day, without other people, we wouldn't all be here. And that's it in a nutshell. And my thanks go to each and everyone for being such special people in my life, anyway.
That's very kind of you to say, John, and I'm sure we all reciprocate those thoughts back to you as well. It's been, you know, it's a pleasure to know you. And there's so much that's happened in your life. We haven't even brushed the surface, really, about your visits to the United States, and maybe we ought to say just a little bit about your trips to America before we wind up the interview completely. So just tell the people where you visited and the impressions you found of the States.
Oh, yeah, that is, I suppose, being a country fan and, you know, a guy that loved just country music and everything associated with it, it's the old story. I feel as if I was just born in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, I always dreamed of going to Nashville. Again, I think it's every country fan's dream, the mecca of country music. I know Branston is supposed to be the new mecca. Maybe I'll get there one day. But Nikki and I, we flew to Orlando, stayed in Orlando overnight then. Got the Greyhound from Orlando to Nashville. 18 hours going, which was quite a journey, and 22 hours coming back. I checked that one out. That's more accurate. But the strange thing about it was, at that time, I smoked cigarettes, and the bus was so cold, we had to get off when the bus stopped to get a cigarette in the heat, which was totally crazy. But again, all part of this rich tapestry of life. And the people we met were just overwhelming. Really something else. When we got to Nashville, we stayed in the Sheraton Hotel and went to a little place called the Silver Dollar Saloon in Nashville, which unfortunately isn't there anymore. It's one of the Hard Rock cafes. Two good friends ran it, Tammy and Tommy. And that night they took us back to the hotel, and we really are lifelong friends with them. They live just outside Nashville now in Madison. And the people in Nashville were so friendly, as were the people in Florida. And we've been up to New England a few times, and I don't know, people get the impression of Americans being loud and big-headed. Nah, not at all. They are the nicest people on this earth. I love them all. Again, I think it's maybe, if you're nice to someone, they'll be nice back, which is a natural thing. And going back to one of the highlights in Nashville, Steve, was when I stood on the stage of the old Ryman Auditorium. That was the original Grand Ole Opry. And what a feeling. That is something that will live with me forever. Just standing there holding that microphone that Hank sang into, and old Mother Maybelle, etc. That was something special. They've revamped it, modernised the old Opry, and they're now back singing in it, creating a new atmosphere. But the atmosphere that was there was just, you just couldn't, there's no way you could put it anywhere. It was just too strong. Just like everyone I'd met over there, everyone was nicer than the other. And that is something really, really special, Steve.
Were you able to perform, or was it just a stand on the stage and dream? Did you sing there?
If I'd had my guitar, yeah, I could have, no problem. But I didn't take my guitar on that trip. But the stage, you just could get into it. And Nashville's a very, very blind-orientated place. There is a school for the blind in Nashville. And I found out everywhere you went, you know, people were saying, oh, you're blind, you don't pay to get in. And, you know, they pointed out a few tactile things, which was good. So, you know, they're not bad in that sort of side of things. If I'd had my guitar, yeah, I'd have been allowed to stand on that stage and sing. No one would have complained.
Wowie, that would have been the ultimate, I should think, for someone as involved in country music as yourself. And I should think going to Nashville was probably a dream come true. I can't imagine how you must have felt being right at the heart of it all, because, I mean, I know a little bit about country music, but nothing really in comparison to you or the people in the States. I know the odd name, and I know I like the odd track, but I should think, I do know that Nashville is the mecca. So, John, just to wind up, have you got any plans for the future? What next in the life of BJ?
Well, strangely enough, I'd like to say just one tiny thing about Nashville, Steve. And this will give you an idea of just how emotional it was for me. I stood on music though in Nashville and just cried. I couldn't hold the tears back. Nothing in this earth could ever stop them. And it was just tears of joy, sheer joy. And I think that says it all about Nashville. But going back, you know, I'm writing for two websites, doing reviews, CD reviews, doing covering shows, and then shortly to start a radio broadcast in a small way. I did it today for a little while, a test run, and it's working not too bad. One or two microphone problems, but we'll get them sorted out. Getting through Christmas and New Year, and just, you know, see what next year's going to bring. I don't plan too far ahead, but, you know, just look for the new year and take what happens.
That's very interesting. Is this an internet radio station? And if so, could you give us a URL so that people could listen, or aren't you that advanced yet?
Oh, no, once I get going, it's on shoutcast.com, and it's the radio station is and it's Country Music Scotland Radio, and the C in Country is capital, the M in Music is a capital, S in Scotland, and R in Radio. My son checked it out today, and it's, even though I was broadcasting, it wasn't shown on their system for a good 10-15 minutes, so I'll have to check out why that's happening, and I'll let everybody know once we go full-time, or even, but I'll be going, doing a couple of test runs tomorrow, and I'll let everybody know when exactly that's happening.
Okay, maybe you could let us know, and we could put it on the various for the people mailing lists, etc., so that people have got it at their fingertips, so to speak. Well, John, we've been talking for an hour and a half now, and I think that's just about as far as we can take it. I take it that you'd be prepared to answer questions if people in the room have any questions to ask you. But on behalf of us all, can I thank you very much indeed for this fantastic interview. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing it, and I'm sure that the people have found it equally fascinating, and you're a great guy, John, and many, many success in the future.
Thank you, Steve. I can only say the exact same about yourself. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you, and I just hope that hasn't been too boring for everyone, and they've enjoyed it as well. Because I feel you're all part of a family, and, you know, good friends are hard to find and even harder to keep. And thank you. Thank each and every one of you. Thank you.
Okay. It's all yours, folks. Any questions for our Christmas troubadour?
John, I did a beautiful interview, and I'm a bit surprised you left out about your singing day. Debut here at For the People down in Uncle Bill's bunkhouse. I wish I'd have had my total recorder. We could have recorded that and you could have played it on your radio program. Beautiful, beautiful interview there, John.
Thank you, Hike. Yeah, oh, I hadn't forgotten about it. It's just we'll make arrangements over the next couple of days to do that. We'll get out to Uncle Bill's bunkhouse. And we'll do some Christmas songs. How's that for ideal?
Have you been hiding things from me, John?
Say that again, Steve.
So have you been hiding things from me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this one is really extra special. You're welcome to come and join. We must arrange a time. I'll get you there, Steve. We'll just all do, you know, some real good Christmas songs, Christmas party songs. Yeah, we'll record them, and I'll play them live on the podcast. That's for sure.
Yeah, nice interview, John. Great, Steve. Really well done, pair of you.
Nice job, John. It was really enjoyable, as I knew it would be. Bummer about the breakup, but it was very interesting. I've worked with Freddie Hart as well, and you're right. He's really a cool person.
Oh, he is, ma. He's just, I don't know what it was. He just, his personality just really, it just shot out that, you know, I could have said that, you know, one of the guys that I felt let down with was Chris Christopherson, who turned out to be 4'11" and not a nice personality at all.
Yeah, I just had a message from Dennis. You've got to go, Dennis, is that right?
Wonderful interview, John and Steve. A real winning team there.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Great interview. I thoroughly enjoyed it. and good job to you too, Steve.
That's very kind of you. Thanks very much. I really enjoyed that one.
John, at where did you do some engineering work then? Did you, what factory was you at, and what components did you make?
I worked a little place in East Kilbride, a little factory called Clyde Fasteners. They, believe it or not, Chris, they made, but it was like a double bolt for the railways at the time, and for ships. One of the jobs I had to do, this is going back to when I was a rebel, I suppose I still am, they made me do a job. Now, you can imagine a component in a capstone lathe turning at 3,500 revs a minute. They actually gave me a file, 4 inches long, an inch broad, to take the edge off this component. These bolts were maybe 5-6 inches in length, you know, with a head diameter of maybe an inch and a half. I mean, to face that, which left a ragged edge. So we'd use that file to take the ragged edge off. Quite a lot was turning in the machine. And it got to the stage, I said, no, I'm not doing it. I just refused to do it. So they suspended me for 2 days, got the guy in from the job centres, the employment bureau over here, and he gave me a file 8 inches long. And again, not, said, I'm not doing it. I just refused. I said, that is made of brittle steel. If that breaks, that's going into me. And I'm just not accepting it. So, yeah, that was the crazy situation that I was in, Chris.
Crikey. Yeah, you'd expected to have a champ or two along or something, wouldn't you?
Well, I phoned the guy that ran Letchworth Engineering Course, Bobby Dunn, that was his name. I phoned Bobby, and I said to him, look, I said, this is what's happening. And he phoned the factory and said, look, there's a tool for that job, you know, why don't you use it? Oh, we can't afford it. I said, what do you mean you can't afford it? He said, you know, a company like yours should be able to afford it. He said, no, we can't afford it. Well, what we'll do is put them on a different job, and that was it. You know, that's crazy, Chris, but that was like what it was then.